head of the CIA, William Colby, expressed surprise that our B-52s are planned for one-way missions. Once an emergency war order was transmitted, the bombers on ground alert would quickly take off from their bases in the United States, fly 8 to 10 hours towards Soviet targets, and find what? The Soviet Union would have already been hit by thousands of warheads delivered by American missiles. Targets that hadn't been destroyed were likely to be surrounded by anti-aircraft missiles, and dust clouds of unimaginable scale would blanket the landscape. Each B-52 was assigned a post-strike base in Europe or the Middle East, where it was supposed to land, refuel, and pick up more nuclear weapons for another run at the Soviets. Would any of those bases still exist if bombers somehow managed to survive their first passage through Soviet airspace? Most B-52 crews didn't count on it. Stan Spray added components from the Mark 28 bomb to his burned board briefing, along with a dramatic flourish. When the bomb's wires short-circuited, a flashbulb went off. The briefing was given to hundreds of officials, with little immediate effect. A study of all the nuclear weapons in the American arsenal was completed by one of Purifoy's deputies in 1977. It provided the Department of Defense with a list of the weapons posing the greatest threat and a timetable for retiring them or improving their safety. The Mark 28 bomb was at the top of the list, followed by the W-25 warhead of the Genie anti-aircraft missile. Despite being the oldest sealed pit weapon in the stockpile, vulnerable to lightning, and fitted with an outdated accelerometer, the Genie was still being loaded onto fighter planes. On the list of weapons requiring urgent attention, the only strategic warhead was the W-53 atop the Titan II missile. It needed a retrofit for enhanced electrical safety. In 1979, the Department of Defense finally accepted some of the recommendations that Sandia's safety department had been making for years, but didn't want to pay for them. The Pentagon agreed to schedule retrofits of weapons like the Mark 28, so long as the cost wouldn't interfere with the acquisition of new weapons. And until the funds were obtained, the Mark 28 could still be carried by B-52s on ground alert. Although the Air Force balked at devoting a few $100 million to improve the safety of hydrogen bombs, it planned to spend at least $10 billion to equip B-52s with cruise missiles. Instead of trying to penetrate Soviet airspace, the bombers would launch cruise missiles 1,000 miles from their targets, turn around, and come home. Until those cruise missiles were available, B-52s were loaded with short-range attack missiles, SRAMs, carried in a rotary rack. It turned as each missile was fired, like the cylinder of a revolver shooting bullets. The SRAMs were designed to fly 100 miles or so, destroy Soviet air defenses, and give the B-52 a better chance of reaching its target. The missiles had a destructive force of as much as 200 kilotons, and a single B-52 could carry a dozen of them. Purifoy was frustrated by the delays. Even the retrofit of the Mark 28, top on the list, kept getting pushed back. Through a friend in the Air Force, Purifoy arranged for General Howard W. Leaf to visit Sandia on June 13, 1980. Leaf would be given the burned board briefing. The safety problems with the Mark 28 would be outlined in detail, as well as the history of nuclear weapon accidents and the development of weak-link, strong-link devices. Leaf had an important job— Inspector General of the Air Force, with the authority to cut through red tape. The false alarm caused by a faulty computer chip at NORAD 10 days earlier had brought renewed attention to the importance of command and control, the limits of technology, the risks of human error. After lengthy meetings at Sandia, General Leaf returned to Washington, D.C., and commissioned another study on the safety of the Mark 28 bomb. On September 15, 1980, Jeffrey A. Zink was pulling an alert at Grand Forks Air Force Base in North Dakota. Zink was the navigator of a B-52. Once a month, he and the rest of his crew would sleep in a building at the end of a runway, with a tunnel leading to their plane. Four or five other B-52 crews would stay there too, along with the crews of their tankers. In some respects, it felt like being confined in a prison. The alert quarters were surrounded by concertina wire, motion detectors, and security police carrying M-16s. Zink and his friends spent most of their time being bored. They would eat, sleep, read books, take naps, watch crap like The Love Boat on TV. But Zink always thought boredom in this case was good. Boredom meant that deterrence still worked. So long as these 50 young men were stuck there doing nothing, America's nuclear strategy was a success. About once a week, however, the klaxons would sound, and life would suddenly become more interesting. Zink had never intended to join the Air Force. In the mid-1970s, he was a long-haired, true-blue hippie attending the University of Pittsburgh and planning to go to law school. One day he walked into an Air Force recruiter's office, thinking it would be cool to fly planes. The recruiter told Zink that his eyes weren't good enough to become a pilot, but he could become a navigator. Zink put aside law school and joined the Air Force in 1977, right after graduation. His hippie girlfriend was stunned, and their relationship soon ended. At first, Zink didn't fit into the tough, regimented culture of the Strategic Air Command. "What have I gotten myself into?" he wondered. "I don't think I like these people." But his feelings gradually changed, and he eventually became a lieutenant colonel. The navigator of a B-52 sat at a desktop in the chin of the plane, a lower level beneath the pilot. Beside the navigator sat the bombardier. They both had ejection seats that fired downward. Their compartment was small, cramped, and windowless, with a ceiling about 5 feet high. Training flights lasted 6 to 11 hours, and they could be rough. The 8 engines were so loud that the navigator and the bombardier, seated a foot or two from each other, couldn't shout loud enough to have a conversation. They had to speak on the intercom. And most of the time, they'd wear earplugs. The B-52 had originally been designed to attack the Soviet Union at an altitude of about 50,000 feet. But Soviet air defenses now forced the bomber to approach at a low altitude, very low. For 3 to 4 hours during a training flight, Zink's plane would fly 150 to 350 feet off the ground. At that altitude, especially in the summer months, the air turbulence was terrible. The hot sun